In the case of Kuwait, the British refused to give it even nominal sovereignty until it looked like it was going to get out of control in 1958, at which point they said, okay, it can have its own post office. But secretly, Britain and the United States agreed that the British would have the right, in their words, ruthlessly to intervene if anything got out of control, internally or anywhere else. And the U.S. reserved the same right to ruthlessly intervene in the bigger countries, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates. U.S. takes the big ones, Britain's allowed the little one. That's the way the game works. Canada picks up some contracts on the side. I won't run through the whole story, but it continues without a change. In 1975, the United States and Britain strongly supported the Iraqi government when it massacred Kurds, huge massacre of Kurds. Henry Kissinger was asked about this in congressional testimony, and he said, yeah, we did it, but you have to understand that foreign policy shouldn't be confused with missionary work. You've got to admire Kissinger for his honesty. He's usually quite straightforward. As soon as Saddam Hussein came in, Britain and the United States, of course, immediately supported him. In 1982, the U.S. took Iraq off the terrorist list, had been on the terrorist list. It was taken off in 1982 so that the U.S. could provide him freely with arms, badly needed agricultural aid, dual-use technology to produce weapons of mass destruction, and continue to support him right through the worst atrocities. Now you hear Bush and Blair and Rice and other hypocrites talking about the terrible atrocities and the mass graves and so on and so forth. Yeah, they knew all about it, and they continued to support him. It had nothing to do with the war in Iran. Continued without a change after that war was over. They continued to support him because it didn't matter. He was a valued ally and was good for U.S. Business, as they pointed out. So yeah, we'll continue to support him while he gasses Kurds and tortures dissidents and does anything he'd like. In 1982, when he was taken off the terrorist list, they had an empty spot, so they had to put someone in. So they put Cuba in. Cuba was put in as a terrorist state, I presume, in response to the fact that there had just been a sharp escalation in the wave of U.S.-backed terror against Cuba that's been going on since 1959. It had peaked in the late 70s, shooting down airliners, ships, bombing embassies, and so on. So yeah, Cuba had to be put on the terrorist list once Saddam was removed, still there. In 1991, that was a crucial time. In 1991, Saddam probably would have been overthrown. There was a rebellion in the south, probably would have overthrown him. The U.S. was in total control of the area. It was after the war. They basically authorized Saddam to crush the uprising. And furthermore, they explained why. You don't have to go to secret documents. You can read it in the New York Times. The New York Times explained that it was right to support Saddam to crush the uprising because Saddam offered more hope for stability in the region than the people who were trying to overthrow him. Thomas Friedman, whose rantings you can still read, explained that, as he put it, the best of all worlds for the United States would be an iron-fisted military junta which would rule Iraq the same way Saddam did, but not with his name. He was a little embarrassing by then. But since we can't get the best of all worlds, we'll have to do with the second best, namely Saddam himself. That was 1991. Then comes 10 years of sanctions, which we're not supposed to think about. The reason we're not supposed to think about them is that they, you know, by the most conservative measures, they killed hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, devastated the society, strengthened the tyrant, compelled the population to rely on him for survival. Otherwise, he probably would have been overthrown a long time ago by the population of Iraq. He would have gone the same way as the list of other gangsters that the same people supported. That's quite a rogue's gallery. Like Suharto, you know all about that. Canada helped support him. He was easily ranked, easily with Saddam Hussein, overthrown from within. Ceausescu, you know, as grotesque as you can get, supported to the last minute by the people now in Washington, Bush 1 administration, overthrown from within. Marcos, Duvalier, Mobutu, you know, quite a long list, and in fact, new names are constantly being added. Overthrown from within, not Saddam. Why? Because the society was devastated. They had this, you had to rely on him just for mere survival. But the same principle, Iraq can't be run by Iraqis. And so it continues at this moment. The people of Iraq are, I'm not talking about the bombers, I'm talking about the general population, are steadfastly refusing to be returned to the colonial status that the current imperial overlord is preparing for them. And it's quite a struggle. You know, it's a the important thing for us is that it's a struggle that we can determine the outcome. It's outrageous to leave it to the people of Iraq to fight this battle. I mean, we can applaud them for doing it and praise them for their courage, but we should look in the mirror and not praise what we see. We should be stopping it. There's no reason why we can't prevent. Why we can't prevent the crime that is being carried out. And it's not in the front pages. You know, it's not a matter of bombing a hotel and this and that and the other thing. It's just this systematic refusal to accept the orders that are being imposed by the proconsul, Paul Bremer of the Pentagon, to try to prevent a democratic evolution in which the people of Iraq will take control of their own country. Some of the most extreme and grotesque measures are actually just economic. The orders which forcefully open the Iraqi economy up to foreign takeover by U.S., Canadian, British multinationals. I mean, that undermines any hope for authentic democracy and sovereignty and also for economic development. Well, we don't have to sit here and watch that. You know, those orders are coming from our governments. We can stop them. And it goes down the list. I'll just end by saying, as you all know, this is the second of the huge mass demonstrations against the war, now the occupation in Iraq. The first one was immediately before the war. It was unprecedented. There had never been anything like it in the whole history of European imperialism, hundreds of years. Europe, I include the United States and Canada. There had never been a protest, anything like it. This is the first time there had ever been mass popular protest against a war before it was launched. Just to see how far we've come in, say, 40 years, remember the Vietnam War. The Vietnam War was launched in 1962. That's when John F. Kennedy sent the U.S. Air Force to attack South Vietnam. That's when he started the programs which drove millions of people into concentration camps. That's when he started chemical warfare to destroy crops and to clear the ground for counterinsurgency operations. According to the Vietnamese, there are 600,000 victims of that. We don't pay any attention to it. We don't count our victims as usual. That was 1962. Was there any protest? I mean, those of you who are old enough will remember. There was so little protest that the event is out of history. I mean, it's literally out of history. Nobody knows it happened because nobody cared. We want to attack and destroy another country? That's fine. It took years before any protest developed. 5 or 6 years later, you started getting protests. By that time, South Vietnam, which was always the main target of the attack, had been virtually destroyed. And then you started getting protests, and it was important. But it was mostly about the peripheral issues, if you think back. It was mostly about the bombing of the North. Well, the bombing of the North was a serious problem, but it was nothing like the bombing of South Vietnam. In fact, it was radically different. The bombing of the North was modulated and planned and careful because it was costly to the United States. When you bombed North Vietnam, you were bombing an internal Chinese railroad. They were bombing Russian ships in the Haiphong Harbor, embassies in Hanoi. You know, somebody might get mad. When you're bombing South Vietnam, no objection at all because they can't resist. They can't do anything. So therefore, they were practically destroyed. To the end, virtually no protest. Now, 40 years later, there's massive protest against wars before they start. And that's really important. Don't think that the planners are unaware of it. You may not study it in school, but they're aware of it. By 1968, after the Tet Offensive, Lyndon Johnson wanted to send 200,000 more troops to South Vietnam. The Pentagon refused. And we know why from the internal documents. They refused because they were afraid that if they sent more troops to South Vietnam, there would be a civil uprising in the United States. They would need them for what they called civil disorder control in the United States, from young people, from women, from minorities, from working people. They just didn't want to send them, and they didn't. When George Bush number one came in, he did whatever president does. He called for an intelligence analysis of the world situation. A piece of this was leaked, which is very unusual. We never learn about them. But a piece was leaked. Somebody in the Pentagon probably didn't like it. And it was important. What was leaked was a discussion of military intervention. It said that in the case of wars against much weaker enemies, which is, of course, the only kind you'd ever dream of fighting if you have any brains. But in the case of wars against much weaker enemies, the U.S. must win rapidly and decisively because otherwise political support will collapse because it's too thin. It's not like the 60s where you can go on for year after year and nobody gives a damn. That's a change, and it's part of a general change. It's part of a civilizing development throughout the whole society, in fact, much of the world. And it's the result of mass demonstrations, but important as they are, they're only a small part of it. They're important because they inspire people to go on and do what really matters, the day-to-day work of organizing, educating, picking up the right local activities, whatever they may be. And ultimately, that does lead to changes. And it'll continue to. We should be looking ahead. It's just to think what's been... Nobody assumed that the huge demonstrations last year were going to stop the war. Mass actions are really important, but a few of them aren't going to stop a juggernaut. They can throw a wrench in the works. They can slow it down. They're not going to stop it. If they continue, they can. They can stop it. They can reverse it. And they can dismantle it. But it simply has to continue. The guys who run the show have a phrase, complicated phrase, called anticipatory self-defense, which is the new legalism, which means unprovoked aggression without pretext, as long as you can get away with it, as long as it's a much weaker enemy. That's called anticipatory self-defense. Well, you know, we ought to be thinking of that too. We have to anticipate what's coming next, not wait for it. And we have to be engaged in self-defense. But defense of the kind of values that a decent person could uphold with pride. That means defense of justice and freedom, not of violence and domination.
Dr. Noam Chomsky!